Wednesday, July the 15th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. As always, I want to make sure that I can thank the patrons of the podcast. So patreon.com/the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Patreon is a place for creators. So especially in the COVID world and COVID landscape, creators are out there not able to do the normal things that they would do. In my case, I do sales as my job, and so and all of them are in person, so it makes it very difficult when no offices will allow outsiders in, as an example. But patreon.com/the Mind and Fitness Podcast is more or less a place for you to place a donation, but I am doing a lot more video content for the podcast. And so I dropped one, as you're listening to this, just yesterday, actually, that's on there and available only for patrons. So let me give a quick shout out to Tony and Francisco and Ashley, Michael, Mike, Todd, Victoria, Chad, Anthony, Jennifer, Eddie, Jenny, Christina, who I just talked to. Christina, what's up? Ross, Julie, Casey, Brian, Sarah, Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart for being patrons of the podcast. In the case of Kim and Barb and Arnie and Helen, they were all patrons going back to 2018. So thank you so much. You're helping keep the lights on. You're helping pay for the equipment, the hosting fees for the podcast service, the email address, pretty much everything to be able to keep this up and running. So it is definitely a labor of love. So this week on the podcast, I've talked about it for several weeks now, Dr. David Hanscom, and it's crazy because actually, let me look this up. Him and I did a podcast together, I guess you can call it maybe a part one, a couple years ago. Let me look at the air date on that. This is what live radio is like, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, come on, previous. Dr. Hanscom and I aired an episode July 18th, 2018. So this is 3 days shy of being the 2-year anniversary of the last time that him and I had a podcast air together. And there's a lot that he talks about in this, but one of the things that I found so fascinating is I think there was something along the lines of a statistic that he gave that there has been more research and ground made in neuroscience and neuroplasticity research in the last year or two than it was like the last 20 years combined. And so I've talked about for a little while, for the last few weeks, about this COVID-19 Dr. Hanscom Thrive and Survive preparedness document, basically. And so that's still available. If you want one, email me at eddie@themindandfitnesspodcast.com. You can message me on Instagram as well. But which is at Eddie Lindenstein, if you ever wanted to follow me on Instagram. It's almost entirely personal stuff, but nevertheless. But it's this guide that I've emailed out to a ton of listeners that have emailed me. I would say 50 or 60 people probably have requested it at this point. And I've sent it out to them, and it seems like they've really liked it. I definitely dig it. So this is the interview with Dr. Hanscom, and I think that you are really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here is Dr. David Hanscom. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. My name is Eddie Lindenstein, and a real treat for me, especially because way back when, right around when I first started doing this podcast, the first doctor that I called to ask for an interview joined me, and it's Dr. Hanscom. Dr. David Hanscom is on the line with me. Dr. Hanscom, are you there?
I am, and thank you for having me on your show.
It's a little different this time because last time we were sitting in the beautiful Washington Athletic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle. I believe you've relocated as well, right?
Well, I quit my practice in 2019 to actually pursue this project full time. And it just got to the point where there's so much aggressive spine surgery being done that was hurting people. And people were doing so well with these concepts we're going to talk about that I just had to quit. I honestly felt compelled to quit to do this. And, you know, spine surgery rages on. Probably 70% of it should not be done. But I'm just doing what I can.
That is, I mean, kudos to you, right? Because that my wife and I were just sitting in our backyard. She was asking me about, oh, what's this interview about? And I had said it's Dr. Hanscom, who's the one that I had interviewed at the WAC, because she's from, you know, she knows the downtown Seattle area well. Her grandfather was a member there. And so she remembers me going to do that interview. But when I came home from that, I remember telling her some of the stats you had given, you know, stats around how many spine surgeries are unnecessary. But maybe the more compelling one is, you know, the sheer number of people that, I mean, you're a spine surgeon, or you were a spine surgeon, and how many people right. You put through a protocol that is not, because surgeons do surgery, right? Meat cutters cut meat, butchers butch, right? Like, that's what they do.
And yet right. you have these other protocols that are making people healthy and happy without having to go under the knife. So I commend you infinity.
Well, I don't want to sound too altruistic here, but I'm just doing what the data says to do. So for 40 years, we've known that lack of sleep, stress, lack of physical conditioning, being overweight, et cetera, all these things that we know are bad for us actually are bad for spine surgery. And it turns out that chronic pain is actually an inflammatory process. It turns out that mental pain is a bigger problem than the physical pain. And since I've talked to you, it's become very simplified in that it's really threat versus safety. When you're under threat, your body responds with a threat response, and you're full of, it can be a mental threat, repressed emotions, physical threat, abusive relationship. Any threat is perceived by the body in a defensive way. So your immune system fires up. Every chronic disease has elevated inflammatory markers, every one of them, including anxiety, depression, psychosis, etc. It's all an inflammatory process. So what happens is that then you do surgery, which is a huge additional trauma, basically on anxiety, and it doesn't work. Probably 70% of spine surgery should not be done. So starting, even at the beginning of my practice, I still would work on the things that the data said to do to calm people down, get them some sleep. But I didn't understand the whole picture very well. Then I, as you know, I went through chronic pain myself for about 15 years, and I came out of it by luck. Didn't know how I got into it, did not understand chronic pain, did not understand how I came out of it. Then the last 5 years of neuroscience, especially the last year, is incredibly compelling to as to the exact nature of chronic pain. It's inflammatory, period. It's not psychological. It's not even, well, it is physical. In other words, what happens, a threat, again, let's talk about mental threat being bigger, a bigger problem because you can't escape your thoughts. So you have a mental threat. It translates into elevated glucose, cortisol, adrenaline, histamines. And that also translates into inflammatory cytokines, which are these little little proteins that turn, they're like little trillions and trillions of switches in the body that help. That basically, without your cytokines, the body doesn't function. They're the final switches that turn things off and on. So there's anti-inflammatory cytokines, or the safety ones, versus the inflammatory ones. And what happens under threat that sustain, you have these ongoing inflammatory cytokines chewing away, turning on white blood cells that are actually physically destroying the tissues in your body. So you're actually going to age faster, you degenerate faster. It's associated with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, cardiovascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, adult onset diabetes. I mean, essentially every degenerative disease is due to chronic inflammation. That doesn't even count the autoimmune disorders, which are obviously inflammatory. But aging has to do with inflammation.
Where, I'm curious, and maybe just because you bring it up, and I'm big into the weightlifting and CrossFit world, and inflammation, and I say that with quotation fingers, is always, it's been, as long as I've been involved in the sport, has been something that's talked about a lot. And it's sort of this, like a chiropractor will say, oh, your inflammation is really, really high, so come get the spinal adjustment, take a bunch of fish oil, eat an anti-inflammatory diet, kind of all these things. Are we talking about the same thing, or are we talking about something different?
Well, again, it's a broad term. So the answer is technically everybody's right. So again, just look at the word threat. I mean, it could be bacteria, viruses, anything that threatens your existence is a threat. And your body's going to respond in kind, so lack of physical conditioning is a threat. So the thing about weight training, which I like a lot, as you know, I'm a huge fan of weight training. In fact, for years, way before I knew about chronic pain, I would get all my patients into the gym 3 to 5 hours a week. But it gets your blood flow going. It also does something to your brain where you're being proactive with these sensations instead of reactive. It gives you a sense of control, which I think decreases threat. Also, obviously, increases blood flow, increases flexibility, stretching, strengthening. All of it is really good stuff in the gym. So exercise has been shown to directly decrease inflammatory cytokines. So people age less quickly when they're exercising. I know you want to talk about sleep a little bit. I have to just digress into the weight training a little bit. I mean, there's a paper which I wish I could find. I'll try to hunt it down again. It was about 35 years ago out of Boston, in the New England Journal of Medicine. It took over 1,000 patients and put them into the gym. Every one of them was over 65 years old. Then they measured their strength before and after the weight training. The median increase in strength was 40% at age 65. And what happens, you lose about 1 to 2% of your muscle mass every year after age 60. Actually, probably a little earlier than that. So they call it sarcopenia. In other words, the muscles actually physically disappear. Weight training not only halts the process, it reverses it. Every patient I have that's active in their 80s and 90s is in the gym. Period. It's unbelievable.
I remember I used to think in my early and mid-20s, like, you know, by the time that I'm 50 or 55 or whatever, I won't be doing this weight training stuff anymore. And I'm, you know, I'll have an RV and I'll drive around the country. I'll do whatever. And I just kind of get to sit back because, you know, there's no value to this stuff once I get to that age anyway. And then in the last 10 years, it's like, oh man, like this stuff makes me feel so invincible. I can't imagine not being the big, strong, jacked 60-year-old guy, which hopefully, you know, hopefully it will be that. But I could talk about that stuff with you all day. I get people from all over the world that were weight trainers, and then they hit this chronic pain wall, and now they're not doing anything because they're afraid of an injury or a re-injury, or you know what I mean.
Well, I'm going to ask you a favor, or a specific ask, and I started a think tank about 6 months ago dealing with this Dr. Stephen Porges, who wrote the polyvagal theory in the mid-1990s, also Dr. Clausen in Seattle, and about 10 other people are in this think tank. And we've been looking at chronic disease, which has evolved into looking at the COVID crisis, which has to do with elevated cytokine. And I think most people have heard of the cytokine storm. And what happens, there's a bunch of things you can do to decrease your levels of cytokines before you get sick. So if you get sick, you're going to stay below that threshold that kills you. And so we're putting together two plans. One of them already released. It's called Thrive and Survive. And it's a 32-page PDF, which I think you saw it on my website, maybe. Anyway, if not, I'll send it to you. But basically, it's Thrive and Survive. It talks about 10 things you can do to decrease your inflammatory cytokines before you get sick. Well, as I've been through the literature, as you decrease your inflammatory cytokines, you just age a lot better. And so, again, the weight training not only gets you stronger, more active, and allows you to stay active to the end of your life, it actually decreases the aging process dramatically. So these are all things people can do. And if you notice people that are dying from the COVID flu or the COVID virus all have, quote, risk factors. Every risk factor has elevated cytokines. Now, you might see like a 45-year-old marathon runner pass away, which we have seen. Well, guess what? I don't know that person's life, what stress he or she was under, but chronic stress elevates cytokines. It's a threat. And I just read a paper a minute ago where, again, repressed emotions are actually even more deadly than felt emotions. And then what became apparent in my practice many, many years ago is that people suffer. And when they come to the doctor's office, there's often some life event, a major loss that changes the body's chemistry, and all of a sudden symptoms that were not there before show up. Where the bone spur might have been there for 20 years, their symptoms started last week. Well, it's probably not the bone spur causing the problem. It's probably the change in the body chemistry that caused that bone spur to become symptomatic. So what we found out is we started to help people just calm down. Again, there's many, many things you can do. As people learn how to calm down and regulate their own body chemistry, they felt safe, right? You have control.
Yep.
Which also directly decreases cytokines and also the inflammation. And so the pain would disappear. Since I've talked to you, we have hundreds and hundreds of patients continue to go pain-free. And it's happening faster because I'm able to explain it more clearly. So if you would be willing to send this PDF to your mailing list, I would really appreciate it. I'm trying to start a massive email campaign with this brochure just saying, look, there's ways you can do to keep yourself alive. If each person contributes their part, the pandemic's over. Right? If people can stay alive, pandemic's over. So, for instance, elderly people, there's things you can do with vitamin deficiencies that help the enzymes and stuff work. So there's a bunch of things we can do actually preventing their deaths also just by showing up their zinc, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin C, of which they're all deficient. So when you're deficient in these ions and vitamins actually help the enzymes function to deal with the bacteria, you get sick because you can't fight it off. So there's so many things you can do to actually improve the immunity and inflammatory response in your body's defenses. And they're very simple, not very hard to do. But the brochure is called Thrive and Survive. The reason why I thought about that is what you talked about in your, you know, weightlifting in your olden age. People, let me ask you a question. So people think of surviving, and if you survive, then you're going to thrive. Is that a fair statement?
I think in most cases, yes.
I don't think you think that, but I think a lot of people think that way, including myself. You're trying to get through the day, and then if you can get through the day, then you'll have some fun, right?
Gotcha.
Okay, it turns out to be the opposite. As you teach yourself to thrive and enjoy your life, process stress, learn how to live life on your terms, not life's terms, you actually, your body chemistry changes dramatically and you do survive. We also know that the stress that kills people is a stress that you can't control. So the idea of stress management is a huge misnomer, because those stresses don't matter. If you can control it, you're going to control it. You can't control chronic pain. You can't control intrusive thoughts. You can't control repressed emotions. And they're all learned skills of how to deal with those things, and they are learnable. And as you actually learn to calm down your nervous system, the chance of surviving is much higher. But people in chronic pain, for instance, live 7 years less, 7 years shorter lifespan than people who are not in chronic pain. People's brains physically shrink in chronic pain. They have double heart disease, double anxiety, double suicide, double depression, double diabetes. All these things are from elevated cytokines. So when you're trapped by chronic pain, again, the mental pain is a bigger pain than the other one, than the physical pain, your body's in trouble and you don't survive. So that's why the brochure is called Thrive, Learn to Thrive. Your body chemistry is optimized and you are going to live longer, a much more enjoyable life.
Would you say that, and it's there's probably a very long answer here, but when I think of, like even just like me as a use case, when I think about my pain at my worst, or when I have different pain issues that may have happened over the years, I can tell you now, like hindsight's 20/20, it's tough in the moment. And if you told me all this stuff in those moments, I would have said, Dr. Hanscom, you're nuts. However, I can look back now and I can say that, you know, life was certainly very, very heavy back then, and my chemistry was probably really out of whack. How fast can that, like, how fast can you throw a stick in the spokes? How fast do you observe patients over the years that their chemistry is all out of whack? They got this symptom, that symptom, this symptom, and then they buy into whatever it is that you're saying or teaching or preaching or whatever it is. Like, how quickly do you start seeing dramatic results? Like, there's a couple of entries in your book, and we're going to talk a little bit more about your new book here in a little bit, but you know, that people start implementing one or two or three things or whatever it is. Is that a pretty quick reversal of getting that chemistry back together? Or does it generally seem to take people a long time?
I'm going to answer the question backwards. So with engagement, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but it's well over 90% of people get better. I mean, it's just because this is not magic. So you don't have to believe in David Hanscom or his book or the Doc Project. So again, the essence of healing is feeling safe. So as you learn the tools to actually regulate your body's chemistry, some people learn it faster. Some people have worse problems than others. So I would say the average is about 3 to 6 months. I've seen people in as little as 3 days go to pain-free. I've seen people probably within 2 to 4 weeks, things start to happen pretty quickly. Most people notice a shift in about 2 to 4 weeks. Once you start this little exercise that I talk about obsessively, as you know, it's this expressive writing exercise, within 2 weeks, people notice a shift. The hardest part about the project is the anger. So people don't want to give it up. Remember, when you're angry, your body's really on fire, right? Remember, the antidote to anxiety is control. When you lose control, your body kicks in more stress chemicals and you become angry. But the problem with anger, remember, the goal is to feel safe. So anger actually helps you feel safe. Plus, with anger, you get a little bit of dopamine and testosterone in the mix, so it actually feels powerful. And you may not be powerful, but it feels powerful. So people give up the anger to feel vulnerable. They don't want to do that. But once you learn how to be vulnerable, and again, it's a learned skill that doesn't take that long, then it's game on. The biggest obstacle is people's willingness to engage. I also tell people it's not a matter of believing me or buying into the concepts. It's a matter of just doing them. And I frequently tell people that you do not have to believe one thing that I said, nothing. You don't have to believe David Hanscom. You know, it's not a belief system you're going to heal. There's nothing to do with that. It's just the way the brain works. It's neuroplasticity. You're going to stimulate changes that cause, you're going to engage in tools that stimulate your brain to physically change. Because your brain changes every second. Every second, your brain's forming new cells. If you learned any one thing in the last 5 minutes, your brain has actually changed structure. So you're stimulating your brain to change. We call it neuroplasticity. So that can happen relatively, so that happens with repetition. What happens quickly is some people say, okay, yeah, I get it. I say, okay, fine, makes sense. And they just relax. And they just go on with their lives. And actually, I use the word play carefully because I know people in chronic pain don't like that word very much until they can't get there. So I do not want to dishonor your suffering, because the suffering in chronic pain is just unbearable. I mean, it's beyond words. That's why I call it the abyss. But you can shift off the pain pathways to giving back, spiritual journey, et cetera, pretty quickly. So many people within 2 to 6 weeks are doing much better. A lot of times, just understanding the problem helps tremendously.
Because suddenly they're not seeing it as, you know, my back is messed up, my neck is messed up. It sort of gives them a little bit better perspective, and it's kind of like, oh, is that
right?
Yeah.
I'm working with a gentleman in New York who is a super nice guy. He's 45 years old. I just met him a couple months ago. And he'd had pretty severe pain for about 7 years and tried everything. Of course, he's very, very wealthy, very accomplished. And within 2 days, he was fine. Now, what he did, he understood the problem. And then he was really good for about 2 weeks, but the COVID crisis came along. His mother passed away, unfortunately. So the stress of it all kicked things back up again. But he got it. In other words, he understood the issue. And even without my help, was able to pull himself into a relatively pain-free state. Now, he's just starting out. It's a learned skill that gets better with time. But the reason why I'm bringing this story up, because there's a specific scenario that is, again, one of the reasons I quit my practice, is that a surgeon told him that he had 8 bulging herniated discs. That sounds sort of bad, right?
Really bad, yeah.
Okay. Degenerated discs do not cause pain, period. End of story. They are normal. They are not a problem. And I don't know, in fact, we actually know where back pain comes from between 5 to 10% of the time. That's about it. That's well documented in the literature. We actually do know that disc degeneration does not cause back pain, neck pain, thoracic pain, nothing. So a degenerated disc simply means there's less water content on the MRI scan. It's actually an MRI scan diagnosis. It's just describing the state of a disc. It has nothing to do with pain. So even bone spurs, ruptured disc, bulging disc, arthritis, none of those have anything to do with pain, nothing. So what happens, people walk around thinking their spine's going to fall apart. They're very afraid. And just understanding that this is a normal finding, it should be actually called a normally aging disc, not degenerative disc disease. So we're actually hurting people by telling them there's something wrong with their spines like that. So even though he had gotten better, I just had a very blunt conversation with him last week saying, look, this is normal. And you can just see him just have his shoulders drop down and go, yeah, great. So a lot of times people realize that they're not going to fall apart tomorrow. And I mean, I think chiropractors do a great job, but they talk about these alignments and subluxations that you have to be careful. That's not true. If the spine surgeon said you have degenerated discs that have to be fixed, that's not true. So, I mean, it's a very long conversation about how all this works. But remember, if somebody tells you there's something wrong, then they can do something to fix it. And guess what? There's a profit margin there. So if you have normally aging, this is so frustrating about the spine issue right now. Do you know what the success rate of spine surgery is for back pain?
Was it maybe like already 15%?
It's like 22%.
Okay.
So I thought it was not. I did 8 years of spine surgery for back pain. I did lots of fusions. I thought the success rate was over 90%. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's about 10, 20, 15%. It's horrible. So then the chance of making you worse in the presence of chronic pain is actually 40 to 60%. You have double the chance of becoming worse than you do of getting better.
I guess the follow-up questions come to mind because there are a couple of people that I'm in contact with in different parts of the world. I think they're actually both in the United States that have had some kind of a surgery. I think they're both cervical surgeries and fairly young people, you know, 20s, 30s, that kind of thing.
Right.
Sometimes it seems like I see stories of people that have had these surgeries and then they come out of the surgery still with pain or with more pain. You know, they may go back to the surgeon reimages them and everything looks fine, but they're still in a ton of pain. what I would love to hear, and I hope that this is so, is that even though they've had the surgery, like, they can still get better, right? Like, it's the body chemistry thing, not necessarily that there was a bad repair or something like that.
Right. What I found out, that you can get better from anything. In other words, the brain can rewire around anything. It's like learning a new language. So, for instance, if you're going to learn French, you're going to practice the language, do repetitions, and in 5 years, let's say you speak fluent French, your brain changed, right? Something happened to your nervous system that allows you to speak French. But you didn't learn French by trying to avoid speaking English. Same thing with chronic pain, is that if you're trying to fix the pain, your attention's on the pain, not the solution. What you have to do in chronic pain is develop a vision of what you want your life to look like with or without the pain. The pain is not the issue here. So you can't say, well, the pain goes away, I'm going to do this, this, and this. The real answer is, what do I want my life to look like with or without the pain? So as you move towards this vision, what I call, the new language I call an enjoyable life, then your brain starts focusing on that. So your brain actually starts to change, and it can change around anything. So instead of having your focus on the pain and reinforcing the pain, you're now gravitating towards a new life, which actually physically changes your brain, again, neuroplasticity. But you're not going to learn French by trying to fix your English or avoid speaking English. So I have one gentleman who's had 27 surgeries, 20 years of chronic pain, major suicide attempt, high-dose opioids, alcohol abuse, just the most chaotic life you can imagine. And he contacted me about 6 months ago, and he's been pain-free for 2 years. And he says he's never felt better. He has not felt, he's in his mid-60s now. So he says he's never felt better than he was when he was 30 years old. 27 surgeries. Six of those were spine surgeries. Two of those six were neck surgeries. And he feels fine. So what happened, he was in Palm Springs area. He worked with a physiatrist that he would call a healer. Helped him calm down, get going. Then he got a hold of my book and website about a year and a half ago and started going through the process. But he made the basic decision that I'm not going to live like this anymore. I'm simply not going to do this. So he decided not to be a victim. Now, it sounds whatever, but what it does, it changes your body's chemistry dramatically. Because if you're trapped by pain and feeling sorry for yourself, your body chemistry is super inflamed and you don't feel very good. So what the medical world is not telling patients about is that your threats, physical or mental, translate into profound changes in your body's chemistry, which physically destroys the tissues. Just physically destroys your tissues, including brain cells. People's brains shrink in the presence of chronic pain. Alzheimer's is an inflammatory disease. I mean, people with Alzheimer's don't have just their brain shrink. That's not psychological. You have a brain that's smaller. So what happens, again, say sustained inflammation actually damages your body badly.
The stuff about Alzheimer's and some of the other things you mentioned earlier is kind of blowing my mind, to be honest. What about, and you've mentioned it a couple times, but COVID, and we haven't really talked about that. I got an interesting text from it. So I co-run a group on Facebook for TMS, and we have qualification questions for people that enter. They have to have read a book on the topic. They have to have a good understanding of what it is. They have to have some kind of a belief. It can be a minimal one, but they have to have some kind of a belief in that this stuff will work. And I'm starting to see your name popping up a lot more when people are listing what it is that they've read. But one interesting thing that the partner of mine that I run this with sent me a text this morning and had just, there was some article in the Atlantic that came out this morning that was talking about how COVID may last as a residual in somebody, meaning they could have symptoms for months and months and months. This could go on for a long time. And he had said, I wonder how much that, like, not overcoming symptoms could play into the TMS stuff, the same thing that we're talking about with back pain and all these other things. If you're not comfortable commenting about that, I totally understand. But is there any, I mean, to me, I see it as body's chemistry changes, your immune system is weaker, you catch something, whether it's a previously known coronavirus like a common cold or the one that we're talking about right now. How does this work intersect with a current pandemic, if at all?
Well, let me back up and make one point, which I think is really critical. So you don't have to believe in anything. In fact, it's actually, If you don't believe, you don't believe. So in other words, it's about connected and engaged thinking. So, because remember, repressed emotions are a threat. Pretending to believe when you don't believe, that's a threat. So the answer here is connecting with what is. So the only thing you have to do is, I will call it suspension of disbelief, just enough to actually engage in the tools. So the only key is whether you do it or not. It's not about belief systems or not. I do agree with you of actually reading background material so you understand chronic pain. But the really key issue is connecting with who you are. And, you know, it's the, does that make sense? I mean, I know it sounds really subtle, but it's really critical that if you think this is not, if you think everything I'm saying is nonsense, that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't want that to stop you from getting better. And conversely, you don't have to believe in David Hanscom to get better either. That is, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying now, but when I'm thinking of the perspective of somebody that's sitting in their car at home or whatever on a walk listening to this right now, and if they have this big doubt that any of this stuff is true, then they will not put themselves into the work. Like if I thought that doing snatches and clean and jerks and squatting was total bullshit and wouldn't make my physique look better, then I wouldn't do it, right? Like, but I know that it does because I believe that it does. So that's just what I'm thinking. Maybe belief's not the right word.
So I'm just saying that I'm going to say it's a commitment to healing, and it's a commitment to yourself, and it's a commitment to take responsibility. Because what happens is you take responsibility, you just dig in and learn this stuff, and it's compelling. Let's take me, for instance. You know, I was in chronic pain for 15 years, and I was a victim beyond words, but I didn't know I was. I had no idea what victim was. I didn't know what anger was. I thought it was pretty cool, right?
Yep.
So the first step is based on awareness that I'm aware that I actually am angry as can be. I did have a bad childhood. I totally blocked it. The reason why I got in serious trouble, as you know, I've talked to you before, but there's over 30 possible physical symptoms that occur from ongoing chronic stress. I had 17 of these at the same time. I had migraine headaches, stomach issues, my back hurt, neck hurt. My feet were burning. My ears were ringing. Skin rashes would pop up all over my body. My scalp would itch. So all that reflects a huge body inflammation. Same thing in fibromyalgia. Your whole body's inflamed. Your brain lights up like a Christmas tree. The other thing is, so what I'm saying is that the key to the process is learning to regulate your body's chemistry, and they're just tools. I mean, there's philosophy comes into it. People say, well, forgiveness is a philosophy. No. Forgiveness is a simple act of letting go. It does not have religious connotations. You do not have to like that the person you let go of. So if some person has really injured you, you know, mentally or physically, or an employer or whatever, it's not nice. You don't have to like that person ever. But remember, the person that you dislike is now in your head. Dr. Luskin, a friend of mine, wrote a book called Forgive for Good. So his point was, if this person keeps spinning around in your head, he calls it renting too much space in your mind. And what happens, this person you really dislike is now in your brain, affecting your daily walks, affecting your family life. So the person you dislike is now actually still disrupting your life. Why do you want that person in your life? So the only way you can do that is actually through forgiveness. Let it go. But again, it's not much more difficult than that. But don't let the word forgiveness disrupt you from saying, well, this really flat out is neuroscience, neuroplasticity. And you have to drop away the philosophical connotations of that word. So you don't have to believe in something bigger than you are, even though it helps. Again, it's not a belief system that gets you better. It's simply, again, suspension of disbelief in just doing it. I know it's a long answer for a short question, but it's really critical.
Well, what it makes me think of is I sort of see this evolving work of, I'm going to keep calling it TMS just because that's kind of what it's more widely known as, but PPD or, you know, the variety of different names that it's taken on, stress illness, right? There's a whole litany of different names that people have called it over the years. But I almost see like two camps on this, and unfortunately, like, Dr. Sarno is no longer with us, so he wouldn't really be able to speak on this, but I see like Dr. Sarno and Steve Ozanich, who's wrote a really, really great book on this, and maybe even Nicole Sachs to a lesser degree, is a little bit more on the philosophical side, whereas it seems like you and Dr. Schubiner, I haven't heard Dr. Schechter talk too much on this, but certainly you and Dr. Schubiner seem like you're more on the brain science side of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, I totally respect Dr. Sarno's work. I mean, he's a pioneer. He brought it forward. he did invent it, though. It was actually around in the 20s. Henry Benson in the 50s actually was doing this type of work. And it's been around for a long time. But the only reason I'm not calling it TMS or NPD or mind body syndrome anymore is that when I talk to patients about, look, your body has a sustained stress response, is under chemical assault on a daily basis, it has a very real physical and mental effect, it just makes sense. The problem is when I put a name out there like TMS or mind body syndrome, all of a sudden there's a diagnosis they have to think about, what's the nature of pain, et cetera, et cetera. So I found that the last 5 years has actually dropped all terminology, including the word NPD. It's just easier for people to lock onto it. That's all.
Yeah. One of the challenges that I've had, and it's interesting because the I feel like the closer to me that people are that don't live in my house, sort of the less they believe that all this stuff is even true, that you can have such debilitating symptoms over something that is so, I mean, the stuff we're talking about, the change in body chemistry and all that, though complicated in a way, the solution is not really all that complicated. And it seems like it should be, because when you go and meet with a spine doctor and they're like, you know, the synovial joints and the fluids and all the, you know, the canals and all this kind of stuff, that seems very complicated. But the stuff in, like the direct your own care, like it's step one, step two, step three, step four, right? Like these things that you go off and do. So I guess like if I were an outsider that listening to this right now, I would say, well, that doctor's just telling me, I mean, what do? I pour myself a beer and I sit in front of the TV and relax and that's going to fix all my pain. You know what I mean? With that kind of sarcastic tone.
Right. I get it.
So, which I'm sure you've heard a ton in your career. People that kind of have a response that's sort of like that a little bit more, you know, just hemming and hawing or whatever. Right. I guess what would be your comment on that? Maybe it's not really that good of a question, but.
Well, no, it's okay. I mean, I think that's the biggest block. I mean, I swear that in my practice, I just had to let go. So if somebody's really not into engaging, I don't want to use the word belief anymore, but if they don't want to do it, then they don't want to do it. And so the problem is that reaction is part of the disease that blocks the treatment. So if you're frustrated, angry, not believing people, reactive, that's a survival response. Remember, anxiety is not psychological, neither is anger. It's just your body's reaction to a threat that says danger. And the reason why that's so critical is that survival reaction to a threat processes about 20 million bits of information per second. The conscious brain processes 20 million versus 40. So if you're angry and frustrated, I call it phantom brain pain, you have these circuits spinning in a way. They're like mini tornadoes that you can't penetrate. They're not subject to rational control. And anxiety is just a sensation generated by elevated stress response, elevated cytokines, elevated chemicals. And the way you decrease anxiety is simply drop down the stress chemicals. But the problem is your chemicals are so high that it actually shuts down the blood supply to your brain, which it does. And when you're in chronic pain, it actually decreases the size of your brain. You can't think as clearly. So that what happens, which I think is really sad, is that it's not like the person's a bad person that's not believing. They actually can't. They can't believe because their brain is actually functioning what it was like 20 years ago before they had pain. Now, the good news is, and I was in the same way. When I was in the worst part of my chronic pain, I had a hard time processing new information. I kept the old, but I could process new. But the good news is once you actually solve chronic pain, not only does your consciousness come back or your cognition come back, it expands dramatically. So the fun part for me is that when people come out of the hole of chronic pain, not only do they come out of the hole, they actually thrive at a level that they never knew was possible. And that's from my experience. And I was in a deepest, hopeless hole. They estimate that the impact of chronic pain is equivalent to terminal cancer. Because you're in a hole, you're bounced around, nobody can tell you the problem, and what's the end point? There's no hope. So I was there. It's a desperate situation, and you're not thinking very clearly. So I was in that spot for a really long time. 15 years is a pretty long time. I do have one woman, by the way, who's in chronic pain for 55 years, who's now been pain-free for about 6 years, and she's just delightful. She's 85 years old, and she's so happy. So we do know that neuroplasticity can occur at any age. And I just want to touch on the question you asked a while back about, if you've had prior surgeries, can you get better? Again, I want to do my long answer for a short question. The answer is yes. So when this gentleman with 27 surgeries got better, I was blown away. I did not think that was possible. We now have cases of phantom limb pain where the phantom limb pain disappears. So remember, brain pain is only interpreted by the brain. You're interpreting sensory input, and your brain says it's painful or not. Without a brain, you would have no pain because you're just interpreting sensations. So there's nothing about a hot stove. There's nothing, if my skin or hand touches a hot stove, there's nothing in my hand that says this is hot. It's only when that impulse goes to my brain says danger in a big way, then it's hot, you pull away your hand. But it has to be modulated by the nervous system.
So that's sort of like the, it's almost like the font size for everything that you're typing out on a page, right? If your font size is 150, everything that happens on that page suddenly looks massive and big and explosive, right? Is kind of right. What it's making me think of. It's interesting you say that. There's two things that you said that ring so true. Is that my mother-in-law had her arm amputated in 2015, and for a year and a half after that, she would make comments to my wife and I and say, "My arm is killing me." We'd go, "What arm?" And she would say, "The right arm. There is no arm there." But she was having the phantom. You know, that went on for a long time. And I feel like it was gabapentin maybe that was recommended to her. And that was way before I heard about any of this stuff. But I think we talked a little bit about phantom pain before. And this morning I burned my hand on a hot stove. So it's interesting that you say that too. My oldest daughter looks at me and she goes, "Are you mad?" And I'm like, "I just burned my hand on a hot stove. It hurts."
Let me ask you, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead and ask your question.
I was jumping into a whole new topic. So were you going to add to that?
Well, I should ask you a question. So if you put your hand close to a hot stove, why would you pull it away?
Because it hurts.
But why? Why does your brain say that it hurts?
It's called
the nociceptive system. So something in the past, either your parents told you or everybody has some experience with something being too hot and it's unpleasant and it's dangerous. So our entire experience today is programmed by what we learned in the past, right?
Yep.
Everything. And so what we've been calling PTSD, I don't like that term either, because that's how everybody's programmed by their past. So I agree some pasts are very chaotic, and mine was a disaster. So I had PTSD myself, but everybody does. Anytime you're anxious or frustrated, something in the present reminded you of something in the past that was unpleasant. So if a person walks up to you that looks like the bully in grade school, what's your body going to do? Right? It's an automatic reaction.
Yep.
So that same person walks up to me, it wouldn't make any difference at all. So not every person that looks like that is a bully. To me, it is to you. So that's all about programming. So again, this whole pain thing is about programming. So look at these cage fighters or football players or these people that can put all these ballerinas that can put all that pressure in one toe. Why can they do that? Why can you be an NFL football player and play the next week where it would take one hit for you and I, maybe not you, but for me, one hit, I'd be down, right? So it's all a matter of interpretation and it's programmable.
Yeah, that's something I think about often when I go off of usually I'm on like, I'll do like a 12-week snatch and clean and jerk cycle or a squat cycle or whatever. But, you know, coming off of that for 2-3 months or whatever, almost like an off season, then going back into it certainly has different feelings. It's almost like the callousness of it has worn off or has gone away a little bit.
Right.
So there's a couple things in your new book, which is called Do You Really Need Spine Surgery? Take Control with a Surgeon's Advice. I was surprised because when I got this sent to me, there was already a litany, a build, and I haven't looked at it in the last few days, but already quite a few reviews on Amazon for it. Correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like this, so the previous book that you had written Back in Control, and you had a couple of editions of that, seemed like it was written more for, I don't want to say the novice on this stuff, but it, you know, very much I would have put it in the same camp as like Unlearn Your Pain and Unthink Your Pain and people that, you know, they've heard about this topic and they're going to jump into that world and here's kind of your way out of pain. This to me seems like it's more of a perspective of somebody with a quote unquote damaged back or somebody that's gone to see a surgeon or a doctor and they say, "Hey, you need spine surgery." And the idea is that they're picking up this book to say, "Do I really need it or not?" Is that is that your target for this?
Yes. And the reason why I wrote the book, because there are so many patients, as I've said before, probably at least 70% of spine surgery should simply not be done easily.
Yep.
And so the basic message is somehow we have sort of, it's like an urban legend that if we've tried everything else, let's try back surgery. And that works if there's something wrong. But again, a degenerated disc is normal for somebody's age. It's been documented to not be a source of pain. The success rate is about 20 to 30%. The chance of making you worse is about 40 to 60%, about double the chance of making you better. Then when you're worse, and you've already had surgery, nobody wants to take care of you. So the first message of the book is, don't do surgery unless you can see the exact problem. So just because you've failed everything else doesn't mean you should have surgery.
One of the biggest things that is so striking to me about this book is that I get a lot of messages from listeners that say, I read books X, Y, and Z, and it didn't cover my specific little most nuanced injury or issue or whatever it was. As I'm just scroll or thumbing through the book, like literally there is a section on just about anything you can think of: a severe curve without limitations, spinal right. deformity, general deformity principles, degenerative right. spondylolisthesis as a non-structural issue type 2. Like there's a couple of paragraphs, it seems like, on every type of back issue you could have.
So the way the book's designed, the first third of it is actually a really quick read, because what happens, it tells you things that are possible to fix versus what they're not, and the general characteristics of those. So that's two choices, is either structural or non-structural, where you can fix structural, not fix non-structural, and also the state of your nervous system. So if your nervous system is calm with an identifiable problem, people do beautifully. If you have a fired up, hypervigilant nervous system, results are a disaster. So if you have a structural problem and fired up, the goal is to get calmed down first and then do the surgery. What we found out is that we calm people down even with structural problems that normally would have surgery. They would cancel the surgery because the pain disappeared anyway. So my chance of actually doing surgery in person and walked in my office the last five years of my practice was about 4.5%. Wow. I literally put myself out of business. So, and then the second part, if you don't have anything you can see, then surgery is just off the table. And so the first part gives you the principles, and then the middle section gives you a little bit of background to it about the nervous system, et cetera, how you make those choices. Then the last section, you just have to look up only your diagnosis. So it takes the principles, then you just have to look up your specific diagnosis and say, okay, each diagnosis can be structural or non-structural. And so it allows you to get through it in about 2 hours. You can just figure out whatever you need to know. So it's arranged on a grid that's organized, so it allows people to make a very clear decision relatively quickly.
One of the sections that I was so fascinated with, and I need to go back to Back in Control and read what you had written about it back then, but was the whole, because there's various things that you write in here about the state of the nervous system and things you can do to sort of regulate it or downregulate it. But the one that for me, because I had such a, well, I mean, not compared to a lot of people, maybe I had 2 years, 2.5 years of like pretty intense pain between my shoulders and my neck and my back and sciatic and all that kind of stuff, which that is, I mean, it felt like 50 years. It might as well have been. But I remember when I had met a therapist back then, the first thing he asked me was, tell me about your sleep. And at that time, my sleep habits were four and a half hours a night, which I felt like was fine. I was training, I was in the weight room and all that kind of stuff. But then like the tidal wave hit, and then it was just one issue after another. And then finally I just cut the whole thing off, but my sleep was still the same, 4 to 4.5 hours. And I just never put two and two together that would have been the case. In the last 3 months, and I wear like a sleep tracker that gives me like a, you know, it does my heart rate variability throughout the night. It does my blood oxygen levels. It does, and it gives me a score, like an aggregated score at the end of the night. How much REM am I getting? How much deep sleep am I getting? Since I have put an emphasis on the sleep part of it, because I was like, well, we're all in quarantine now. What the hell else am I going to do? Here's something else I can focus on. And with kids, it's like, put them to bed and I'm so smoked by the end of the day anyway. I can put myself down. But my average sleep score was about a 75 out of 100, previously. And then when I started putting an emphasis on it, there's a buddy of mine that owns a nutritional supplement company. And this is the one supplement that I take. And it's got magnesium, GABA, zinc, vitamin D, and 1 milligram of melatonin. So very, very mild. But basically something to get me into a much deeper sleep. And my sleep scores now are for an entire week are never less than 85. But typically they're somewhere in that high 80s to around 90 on there. And I would still have you know, prior to really setting an emphasis on the sleep part of it, I would still have moments where if life got really chaotic or tough, or my kid was having a bad day, or work was really hard, or somebody didn't sign a contract with me, or whatever the case was, I would still have that spot in my mid back that would start to kind of light up. Conscious stressful stuff would still give me an ache and a pain, and you know, it may go away in 20 minutes or an hour or whatever. I have noticed that since the sleeping has been much better, the symptoms just don't happen, or I don't get as riled up about things, or it just feels different. And that it feels tough to describe, but I know that you know what I mean.
Well, chapter 14 in my book, Back in Control, is only on sleep. I've said this since the very beginning, before you even started the pain project, that if you are not sleeping, none of the rest of the process really works that well. I mean, you can obviously make a lot of progress, but sleep is still the cornerstone of the whole thing. Then there's a study out of Israel on a very large four-year study looking at chronic back pain, and they found out that lack of sleep actually caused back pain. And they didn't find the reverse causation. In other words, I've always thought that people with chronic pain couldn't sleep because of the pain. It turns out that lack of sleep actually causes the pain. So chapter 14 of my book is only about sleep. There's six things you can do that are on your own. You describe some of those. And there's two things under doctor's control. But there's things called sleep hygiene. You can do expressive writing at night. But absolutely, I mean, think about chronic pain. The way you solve chronic pain is you understand the nature of it, awareness. Then you treat every aspect simultaneously, so everything helps, and sleep is a big one. So addressing sleep specifically is really critical. And then the third part is you take control of your care. So I always encourage people to go to chapter 14 of that first book and actually look at sleep. You can also go to my website, backincontrol.com, which also addresses sleep pretty clearly. I'm coming out with a new software program in about 2 months that actually goes through the whole process in a self-directed manner, with sleep again being a big issue. But yeah, it's a huge, huge factor of sleep. And again, it goes to your inflammatory levels. Your lack of sleep creates elevated inflammatory markers.
For anybody following along, chapter 14 is page 237. I have it right. Okay. I have it in my nightstand. I just pulled it out to take a look at it. You know, one last thing, and this is kind of a selfish question I'm just curious about, because like I said, I do get plenty of athletes and former athletes that reach out to me and ask, because that's kind of my thing, the Mind and Fitness podcast. It's such a big part of who it is that I am, and that's kind of the essence of this podcast. Is I was an athlete that started having a ton of pain, and then I was totally out of it, and now I'm back in it and stronger and better than ever. When it comes to, I guess, people that are athletes, or like I have a buddy of mine messaged me, said his kid tore his ACL a year and a half ago, had the ACL surgery. He just cannot bring himself to get it. Like, his head is just not back in the game. I think there's a big fear of re-injury, as an example. Talk about maybe a little bit around like an athlete's mind, and are there any certain traits that make people that engage in athletics different or tougher to grasp this stuff, or maybe tougher to overcome it, or anything, any sort of a pattern maybe that you've observed in 40 years with athletes versus non-athletes?
Well, I don't know if it's athletes I think high performers in business, law, medicine, business, whatever it is. I mean, you're a high performer also. So the answer is yes. And what drives a lot of people is anxiety. In other words, you come from a lot of myself and colleagues come from very difficult childhoods, very difficult past. And you sort of overachieve to compensate for that. And again, I don't know his past at all, but there's something in you that keeps saying, not good enough, not good enough, not good enough. So that drive is a threat, creates anxiety, creates inflammation. Then when he has fear of re-injury, again, that's a threat, right?
Yep.
That is not psychological. That is a mental threat that's translated into elevated inflammatory cytokines that actually causes the need to work to hurt more. So on stage one of my website, there's 5 steps, starting with expressive writing, the relaxation tools, sleep is a big one. So there are a bunch of things to do in a stepwise manner that's outlined in the website, which is the action plan in the book. But it's not mind over matter. What doesn't work is mind over matter. You just go out and just do it. Well, again, you're repressing fear, which is even a bigger threat than actually feeling fear. So the answer is it's very solvable. But again, I'd be happy to talk to him, by the way. Also, let your listeners know that every Tuesday and Thursday at 12 o'clock Pacific time to 1 o'clock, I have an open question and answer period where people simply hop on and answer questions about this stuff. And so I'd love to have you on board. We have a lot of fun. For me personally, it's just been a great thing. I learned something every week. And so every Tuesday and Thursday from 12 to 1, it's on my website under the calendar. Just hit the link directly and you'll be right on the meeting.
Oh, awesome. So
that's a resource for you.
That's great. Well, I promised that I'd get you out of here before 5 o'clock. Are there any other closing comments, remarks, or anything that you're thinking of that maybe we didn't get to?
Yeah, again, I just want to summarize that anxiety is not psychological. It's your body's response to a threat. And think in terms of threat versus safety. And the essence is that once you understand how your body works, then it allows you to take control and actually feel safe. And it's just game on, just a matter of time. So please, quote, suspend your disbelief. You don't have to believe it, just simply do it. And it's not very hard.
And then your website where people can find you, is it backincontrol.com?
Correct.
Okay.
That's for both books, and that's correct.
Okay, awesome. And actually, it looks like you've had a redesign on your website since the last time I saw it. It looks awesome.
Yeah, it's totally redone. So it's much easier to follow. People are getting better faster. And again, I'd love to talk to you again. There's a whole section on family issues that we didn't understand until about 2 years ago. Turns out your family is actually your biggest trigger by far. And once you understand the problem, then you actually can solve it. But yeah, the family issues are just a massively big trigger holding you back, but also helping you go forward.
I could talk about this stuff with you all the time. I went back and I listened to our first interview from a couple of years ago, and we had closed with you saying we really need to do a whole episode on family issues. So we will still do it, and it's still coming. But you've got this new book that's here again. Do you really need spine surgery? Dr. Hanscom, thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
All right. Take care.